internet, you're 31. You have a better shot with a handgun in your mouth. My name is Matthew Crowe.
And are we still talking about tennis? My name is Shahir Dowd.
Aren't you everybody's type? I'm Izzy.
And this is the only podcast about movies, specifically the film Challengers.
Challengers.
I was going to do a different wording, and then I decided to just go with it. Izzy, welcome back.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
This was such a last minute addition, and I was like, oh, the perfect person to talk about this would be Izzy, because I think this is your kind of movie. Am I wrong about that? Or are you going to come in and shit on this movie? Just so we have a fair warning.
I think you hit it on the head. Okay. You got an ace, if you will.
And I gotta say, the optics of the triangle that we have set up in here was not intentional in any way. So if anyone's thinking that was part of the decision making, get your minds out of the gutters. This was just the way it turned out to be.
It's Matt, because we're all tennis stars. We're all really good at tennis.
And I did get injured this week, actually.
Oh, playing tennis?
No, walking down the stairs. So
that's how you know you passed your 30s.
Exactly.
This is also the first episode we've done in a little bit, because we pre-recorded a couple of episodes the last couple of weeks. So it is the first time I've actually talked to Matt in a few weeks. How have you been, buddy? We both had birthdays this week. We typically do a birthday episode somewhere around here, but we haven't gotten around to that this year. Because I think once you get past 40, who's celebrating anyway, right?
Hey, who's past 40? I'm 107. No. I'm good. A little bit older, feeling a little less wise. I thought it was supposed to go up too, but that doesn't really work. Shahir was very lovely. He for my birthday, Izzy, he bought me a very nice bottle of tequila, I'm guessing from wherever he went.
I was in Mexico this week on vacation. I had not an unplanned vacation, but it kind of snuck up on me. So I was like, madly rushing around at the last minute to try and get ready for a vacation. Didn't really have any time to prepare or think about it. One thing I did, Matt, we've done this episode many years ago when we talk about movies and places.
Yes.
And we were in Spain. I can't remember what the movie was. It was called Flowers, right?
Yeah.
That's right. We did a film called Flowers and we recorded it in Spain.
We were in Bilbao.
In Bilbao, that's right.
Okay.
And
did in the an street,
episode,
Izzy.
We
in
did an
street?
Episode on the streets of Bilbao. talking about a Spanish movie film. And this week, I was just like, what am I going to watch on the plane? I haven't even really thought about it. And I picked up, because I went to a small town called Puerto Vallarta, which was beautiful, by the way. It's a stunning town. I highly recommend going. And the film that is famous for from that region is a John Huston movie, which called The Night of the Iguana, which I believe you've seen, Izzy, if I'm not mistaken.
I have, yeah. And
I love it. It's great, right?
Yeah. I mean, for me, as someone who like studies star personas pretty closely, yeah. I mean, having Ava Gardner and Deborah Carr in the same film together is just like watching two titans with like opposed personalities kind of battling it out. And that's my favorite thing in the world. So,
and also,
I love
Ava Gardner is kind of like seasoned at this point. And
she's
like confident and like there's no like. There doesn't feel like there's any
baggage
gloss.
Anymore. Yeah, there's no gloss on this woman anymore.
No,
but
she's still a great screen persona. She's like, steals the scene every time she's in it. But is this kind of like we've gotten past the glamour stage? Like it's kind of amazing. And Richard Burton is the sort of washed up alcoholic who seems to be pretty on the line about having an affair with an underage girl. It is kind of an amazing performance as well. It's like, it's pretty unhinged and I did love it. It's a really great movie.
I feel underseen.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're mentioning it now. Coincidentally, I also was just in a Deborah Carr location
because
I was visiting a friend who lives in Hawaii, and I was like, I'm sorry, I'm forcing you to go to the From Here to Eternity Beach, but we're going.
That's right.
And so we went out there.
I felt very smart for a second because you were like, what beach is this? And I chimed in.
Yes. And you knew. You knew. You got
well,
it.
Well, it's iconic. It's iconic.
It's very, like, yeah. When you see it, you're like, oh my God, it looks like deep. It looks.
Yeah. And also, like, why would you ever want to be rolling around in the sand kissing on that beach? Because it's like, it would just be very uncomfortable.
Yeah, but it is a gorgeous beach. Yeah. I, like, truly one of the best beaches I've seen in maybe ever. It's very beautiful.
What's wrong with the sand?
Sand, as Anakin Skywalker once said, sand sucks. I don't think those were his exact words, but you know.
I believe if I want it, hold on. It's coarse, it's rough, it gets everywhere. That's, there we go. That's the line. But I know I was because, you know, some beaches, you know, this is the only podcast about beaches. Some beaches are. Yeah, it's just, we're going to talk about beaches. No,
Coney Island. Yeah.
Yeah. But like the sand is more like tiny rocks. And I didn't know if that was the kind of beach it was.
No, it was like a very beautiful sandy beach. Oh, okay. It's like surrounded by cliffs.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Which I'm not sure that's necessarily obvious from the film. It's like right next to a highway.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Well, before we get into the podcast, into talking about challenges, there's two things I want to mention here. In continuing the theme of sand, I recorded a special 3-minute bonus piece of content with my son, who watched Dune 2 a couple of weeks ago and the latest Bluey half-hour episode. And there were quite a few people on the internet who wanted to know his opinion of that. So stick around to the end of the episode so we can hear what he thought of Dune 2. There are some pretty, pretty hot takes in that discussion. Which
spicy takes, one
some
might
spicy
say.
Spicy takes. Izzy, are you a fan of Dune 2? Did you see it? Did you care?
I haven't seen it.
Did you see Dune 1?
I have seen Dune 1, but I watched it on TV, so I feel like I didn't get the actual experience of it.
Right.
Mm. I liked it a lot. I would like to see Dune 2 at some point. I just haven't made it out there yet.
And then I just wanted to tell a quick, you know, we were just talking about beaches. One other thing that is not movie related at all. I got to visit this incredible beach called Isla Marietas, which was amazing. You had to, you take a special tour. It is a beach off the coast of Puerto Vallarta where the military had bombed this beach for military testing and created a hole in it where there is this one beach, and it is a protected zone from wildlife and for wildlife and animals. And so you can only be on this beach for 30 minutes and you have to swim to it. They drop you off in open water about 100 meters away and you have to swim through a cave to get to it. And then you're on this beach. I can show you some photos later. It is quite possibly the most spectacular thing I've ever seen in my life. This isolated, basically an island with the hole in the middle of it. And in that hole is a beach. And then because I was, I happened to be on this tour by myself. I got to go in some extra caves by myself as well, which was just mind blowing because they're, because of the holes in the beach and the time of the day we were in there, and because of the water spray, you get these beautiful sun rays that come through the water, and the water is azure blue, crystal clear. There was a lot of jellyfish. I did get stung quite a few times by jellyfish.
Oh, no.
But it was just, one of those just mind blowing experiences. And if I could film in this beach, it would be a pretty amazing thing to kind of be able to get this. So I wanted to share. We were just talking beaches for a second.
Well,
I wanted to share my beach.
That sounds
experience.
So cool.
You two and your fancy beaches. I went to Fitchburg, Massachusetts. There was no beach there, but I did.
Was there an Applebee's?
Well, yeah, there wasn't even an Applebee's. I did go to an old bar. No, I was speaking at my college.
Oh, nice.
Which was very, very
cool.
fun.
Did you tell them about us? Did you tell them about
us? So check this out. Okay, sorry. This is a whole big thing, but it will get back to filming. I promise.
Don't worry.
So the reason I was asked to go talk at a panel for the comm media students, and I think because I graduated in 05, I was the elder statesman there, talking about sort of the various industries everyone was in, getting jobs, etc. That was cool. It was fun. It was so nice to be back. Talked to some old professors that I really loved and respected, and it was great to see them again. I hadn't really been back in 20 years. But the coolest part was I got to go to the Visions Film Festival, the student film festival that I hosted 20 years ago.
Oh, nice.
And I got to see what college cinema looks like in 2024.
How is it?
Sick. That's cool.
It's pretty, full honest review. All of the pieces were really good. The docs were actually really, really solid and had excellent. I was shocked at how much they could do with so little. Everything was shot immaculately. The acting was most of the time subpar, but like,
what are you gonna do?
Yeah, it was student film, etc. Yeah, but like, but I'm talking about like the tech they were using, whatever, for like lighting or even just the cinematography, planning shots, etc. was gorgeous. There was one piece though that got me. And it was called Sunset Syndication. And what this was using, I believe, fully old school tech. Like they went to a public access channel to use their cameras. It was basically a bunch of vignettes about like you're flipping through channels and going through static and getting like oh, here's a news channel. Here's home shopping. Here's whatever. But then there'd be through lines, both comedic and scary, that like would bleed between the channels. And it started telling a story, but it looked perfectly analog from students who did not grow up in an analog world.
Yeah.
And so I was, that film blew my mind. Shout out to Sunset Syndication, the student film at Fitchburg State University.
Send it places, you guys. It's, yeah. Yeah. Like they it should
was
send it places.
So fun. So that was very fun. Although I did not get to college was also coarse and rough and it got everywhere.
Did you make student films? I can't recall if your history.
No, I was a political science major.
A legit
international
student.
Relations.
How are international relations these days?
Turns out not good.
Oh no,
they don't. So no, I didn't do anything. I was in a student film.
Yeah.
Okay.
I acted in one.
Oh, and when we said student filmmaking acting wasn't great, we didn't.
Well, I feel like it was just like giving my friend a hand. Like I have no acting experience whatsoever. So I'm sort of like,
yeah,
I can tell you what I've learned in books and that's enough for me, but
fair enough.
Well,
we are here to chat about Luca Guadagnino's new film. We've talked about two Luca Guadagnino films on this podcast. We talked about Call Me By Your Name and Suspiria. But I think in both those episodes, I mentioned the fact that Luca Guadagnino has made one of my favorite films in probably the last 20 years, I Am Love, which I just adore that movie unconditionally and will put it on if I want to have like a weepy session by myself. So I was very excited to see Challenges. But I guess the other thing that was sort of surprising about this movie, as I was talking to a friend of mine who's unaware that it was coming from a filmmaker like Luca Guadagnino, is it felt like just kind of a summer sex comedy of sorts, just from the marketing and trailers alone.
I've heard people say they got comedy vibes out of it on the trailer, and I did not.
What is
you
the
did watch it at 11 a.m. this morning.
No. The film, thanks for blowing up my spot, Izzy. The film obviously is funny. Like, there are very funny moments in the film. But the trailer made it seem like, almost like an erotic thriller of some kind. Like, it didn't sell me on any comedic things, but people have mentioned that you're not the first ones you hear. I guess I just must have missed the comedy in whatever trailers that I saw.
Maybe the feeling was light and breezy. It felt light and breezy, you know, particularly around the April, kind of May, kind of summer, pre-summer releases. It didn't feel like a weighty tome to get into. But Matt, could you tell us what the IMDb synopsis is before we start talking about it?
Absolutely, because otherwise, how would we know? Watch the trailers for the feel-good comedy of the year? I don't think so. IMDb states that Challengers is, quote, Tashi, a former tennis prodigy turned coach, turned her husband into a champion. But to overcome a losing streak, he needs to face his ex-best friend and Tashi's ex-boyfriend.
Dum, dum, dum.
That's
hilarity ensues.
Yeah. Wacky hijinks. Slapstick. Well, someone slaps a dick. slapstick. Yeah.
That's comedy, in my opinion.
That's a good one.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. I worked real. Never mind. So I again saw this at 11 o'clock this morning on the day of this recording. And the theater was fairly empty. I imagine it wouldn't be too heavy at ye old Lincoln Center Theater or Lincoln Square. But I gotta say, with the minimal amount of audience in my theater, it was still like rowdy.
Yeah, like good.
It was in a good way. Like it was, people were reacting to all of the things. And it made it just so much sort of better, even to have like a small group of like 12 to 15 of us, like all interspersed, like, you know, the disparate seating arrangements, because this movie was, in my opinion, super fun. I'll get into more. It's going to be hard to get into sort of true opinions of very specific things. But I liked this movie a lot because it felt like a film you could take like a bunch of different readings from. Like, and none of them would feel wrong. Like, I'm curious what everyone thinks about various elements of it on this show, but I feel like I'm going to agree with all of them in a weird way. Like, it feels like a I don't want to say like a four quadrant movie, but like, I don't know, like you can take a lot from different elements of it.
On that note, I've talked to a couple people who like saw it with groups of, like, I went with my friend, we pretty much had the same take on it, but I've talked to other people who've seen it with groups and all of them kind of interpreted it different ways. And I really like that. I like that there's kind of ambiguity there. I have to be honest, I went into this film with like extremely low expectations because for two reasons. I like Luca Guadagnino, but I've never latched onto his films in the way I felt like other people do, because I do think he has a pretty substantial like fan base. And also because I just had a feeling it was going to be like Poor Things, where like everybody on the internet like loved it. And then I went and saw it and I was like, I don't get it. You know? So I just was like, oh, is this going to be one of those again? And I was just so blown away by it. I loved it. I am obsessed with the structure of it. I'm obsessed with the performances, the characters, the music. Like, there's so much to love about it. And I know we're going to get into all of that like throughout the conversation, but so I don't want to spoil all of it now. But yeah, I just think there are so many positive things to say. And I had a similar experience where like the whole audience was really into it, really reacting. And you seemed to like, you sense like how much energy was in the room. And I love theatrical experiences like that. So it was really just a nice experience to return to a theater and have that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I saw it late last night, and there was a sense that by the final frame and the final cut to black, you lift the theater energized by this movie. And the soundtrack, and I've often said this about Guadagnino, I've heard this phrase about his work, which is that it tends to feel a little overcooked. And in so much as he doesn't feel like he's a aesthetic formalist. He kind of rejects formalism in some way. And there's a lot being thrown at the wall with his movies. And, you know, particularly in a movie like Suspiria as well, he kind of embraces the sort of imperfections of things he's doing. So there'll be like long tracking shots that are really messy, where it feels like the operator didn't find their target all the way through it. But you know, that's part of, he embraces that kind of quality of filmmaking, as well as, you know, like his editing style is really staccato, punctuated by really abrupt shifts in tone and changes in music. Like I said, for me, the first point of contact was I Am Love, and I was completely blown away by that movie. This, I think, is just such a fascinating entry into his body of work, because this embraces all of the qualities that he's like known for and has worked in sort of like formalist films like I Am Love and A Bigger Splash and Call Me By Your Name. Formalist is the wrong word, but high kind of high art kind of films, or philosophy, you know, like films that embrace a kind of philosophical undertone. Whereas this feels a lot more commercial and a lot more of a Saturday night type of movie. And it is a banger. I freaking love this movie. Like, flat out thought it was just one of the most fun experiences I've had in a movie theater, and not dependent on there being a large crowd around me. There was, you know, a smattering of people. I went on a Tuesday night, but everybody loved it. You could sort of sense the energy to it. And it was, to me, kind of reflective of what Guadagnino was doing, because it really comes down to the music. A lot of the music choices are really bold. And it's a really big swing with music. You can imagine taking this whole movie and it being rescored in an entirely different way and being a completely different film. And it's got this sort of, it's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross with this really 90s kind of house music style, but perfectly 2024 and feels, you know, like gloriously, not camp, but within the world of the titling, of Zendaya, of the kind of salaciousness of the threesome of it all. You know, like there's a kind of provocation that's going on with the audience, but it's really fun and lighthearted. I flat out love this. There's a lot to talk about here. Like a couple of things I want to talk about is the writer is Justin Kurtz, who, as we have, has kind of been making the rounds this week, is married to Celine Song, and who, you know, with Past Lives just a year ago, another film about a couple that has a third party enter into the relationship as well. So there's lots of fun tidbits to be had there. And then, you know, I think this is maybe... I don't know if anyone read the book about the Sony hack a few years ago, but there was quite a bit of detail in there about Amy Pascal's sort of theory of filmmaking and the way that she works. And I think this being a Pascal production, not least of which is name dropping Into the Spider-Verse, the probably most successful film in there, I think is a really good reflection of what she's into and really works well and like reflects on her great successes as well, which one of the big ones being The Social Network, you know, which again reunites Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross in this as well. I just love this movie. I love a movie that you can walk out of kind of energized to and like be like, let's go have a conversation about it. The person I saw the movie with didn't love it as much as I did, but we had a great conversation on the way home talking about, you know, like being able to chat about why I loved it, why he didn't love it. And yeah, I just, you know, like what a great start to the summer, you know, like what a great sort of like, I can see this film kind of sustaining a big summer run. Like the other thing that I thought about when I walked out of it was like, my wife absolutely loves tennis. She played competitive tennis all the way growing up. Like this is a movie she's going to just flat out fall in love with. And I was like, I've got to figure out a time for her to go see this. And with a big group of her friends, wherever possible, like she's just going to love this movie. And I think crowds are going to love this movie. It's so good. So good. I got so much to say about this.
Yeah. Can I hop in or do you?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Go.
I'm so happy you said the word camp because this is something I've been thinking a lot about with this movie.
It skirts the line, right? Like it's not. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that really impresses me about this film is that I do feel like the screenwriter has a fluency in kind of like understanding a lot of archetypes and tropes and how to use them like from film history. So like Zendaya is playing a femme fatale.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like updated so it works for this world, right? And I feel like that's also true of the way that the music interacts. Like I left this movie thinking a lot about May December.
Yeah.
Because
And Douglas Sirk. All the way through,
right?
Yeah,
because the music in this film is being used as a melodramatic cue. It's being used to tell you like, this is part of the game. This is part of the tennis match. This like fight that's happening between these two individuals. Like even if it's in a dorm room, it doesn't matter. Like this is the game. And he's kind of like giving you these like dramatic beats with the music.
Yeah.
And I like you could tell I could feel it in the audience that people really loved it. And I was thinking about how that sort of recalled what I think Todd Haynes was trying to do with the music in May December. The problem with May December is that, like, I think that music was like a little too uncanny for some audience
members. It was funny and kind of the wrong. It was the punchline. Whereas this
sort of
I just
think I think Todd Haynes is like using that music in a way that like doesn't necessarily jive with like the vocabulary a lot of people are used to like seeing movies with, if that makes sense. Like I phrase that kind of poorly, but like for me that worked really well. That's like one of the reasons I love that movie is because it was so strange and it set such a strange mood. Although I realized like that made it hard for some people to interpret it. I think with this film, because he's using a music that feels so familiar to the audience, that feels like so, like all of us understand that language. We understand like what house music means, like what this kind of like locked in, like electro pump beat feels like and what that's supposed to signify. Like, it's just a much clearer way of like evoking the exact same technique. So yeah, like, it was interesting to me that people were able to listen to those cues and like go all in with them and not find it funny. Like, yeah, people, yeah, you're not laughing at it, even though it's doing the exact same thing that like what was happening in May, December, you know?
It's funny. It's also, I think, too, it's obviously the style of music, and it's obviously trying to connect conversations and falling in love and tennis like all as one act. Like, mm-hmm, it's trying to put them all together. Another instance, I think, or another reason why it works is the, what I would even consider unorthodox mix. And by, yeah, that, I mean, like, especially in the argument scenes where that stuff happens, where the music hits, the music is way louder, mixed way louder than it would in a typical film it would be. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is another cue to sort of like, not that you're not hearing what they're saying, I always could hear what they were saying, but it made my brain be like, take the emotional ride of it, not necessarily like the pure, like literal what is being spoken ride of it. And that helped make that blend more with the tennis scenes when the music was doing the exact same thing. Again, yeah, I don't understand a lick of tennis. I feel like the score actually did a lot for me to understand like a lot of like good and bad things that were happening in the physical matches. Like I think this is a film, obviously there's so many different elements that had to work and come together to make it work as well as it did. But I don't know if you rescored this with something else, I think it would always be even just slightly worse. Like yeah, there's just something yeah, about the mix, like of all the elements and the mix itself being one.
100%. I think the music is doing so much work here. And I think, Izzy, kind of, it's a really great comparison to Made to Sin, because we talked a lot about the music cues in that film when we discussed it, but I don't think anyone's walking away listening to Joseph Losey, you know, like on Spotify immediately.
I was.
Prison Company excluded. But I think everybody who works out is going to be listening to this album.
Yeah, until they get to the iPhone alarm, and then they're just going to be like triggered and shaking. Yeah.
I think it's doing a lot of that same kind of heavy lifting, but Matt, to your point in terms of the mix, there's a kind of like, again, this is the thing that I think Guadagnino is really good at, or really demonstrates a kind of an interesting kind of laissez-faire about, is that he just throws away like formalism in many ways. It's like in the middle of a scene, a beat will start and you're, yes, like, why at this moment did we do this? But then as you watch, you go, of course, at that moment, this is why we should have this piece of music. And then it'll be matched by, you know, I'm thinking about the scene between Paul and Tashi in their dorm room. And then she kind of gets annoyed during, you know, their intimacy, and then starts stretching, and the camera is just panning left and right, left and right, left and right. The music starts and you're like, I don't know what's going on here, but it's awesome. And
I'm, yeah,
like,
exactly, really?
That
really
shot,
just like moving with, and then it just, as quickly as it comes, it disappears, and you're like, it's such a, like, I can't imagine the editing room being any more chaotic than that, you know, like with such a sort of degree of like, and we're going to cut the music out here completely, and we're going to start it here completely, and it happens to be this really percussive 90s style house music from one of the great industrial brands of all time.
Yeah. That scene in particular, I don't know if it was a single take, but God, it sure felt like one. Like,
yeah, I don't think it is.
It's just so cool. Like that scene specifically with changing from basically, a romantic scene into a fight. Like it was so, and again, even in both of those methods, sort of the going back and forth, looking at different characters, etc., like a tennis match. It was God, and there's so much of those things. Which one of you said that Lucas Steph is overbaked?
I think there's been a criticism,
or you mentioned
that his films feel overcooked.
So, like, this is something I noticed and loved very much about this movie, and I think it even ties into, Izzy, to your bringing up, or actually one of you did, but then you both agreed about camp. The way that, like, there's a bunch of stuff in this movie that if another film tried to do it, I'd have a bitch like, what the, okay. Like, like first person tennis ball shot. or
in the film, you're just like, yeah.
Or yes. Yeah, or like glass floor tennis court shot. Or like all of these, or like basically a fancier GoPro on a racket shot. Like all of these things, you're like, this is on paper, I'd be like, this is stupid. But here, for whatever reason, because of the energy, I'm like, yeah, this is overbaked. Give me more of it, please. Extra crispy bacon now. Like that, it just feels good.
That is kind of my answer to one of the main criticisms I hear about this movie, which is a lot of people who have seen it have been really actually kind of underwhelmed by the eroticism of it because it's really sold as this like erotic thriller. And a lot of people are like, oh, well, is it actually erotic? Like there's some like sexual moments, but like, you know, there's no release. There's no.
No one has sex in the movie.
Like yeah, there's no like, you know, it, but I'm exactly. And I'm like, but there is. It's the tennis.
Yeah.
Like all of the tennis is the eroticism. Like that is such a like he preserves all of that like choreography and like intimacy and like roughness and passion like for the court.
Yeah.
All the time. And I think like to me, it feels very limiting to say that it's not erotic because there's no like gentle, passionate caress between these two people because like the three of them don't actually care about each other. They care about tennis. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
and the only release in the entire movie is the very end.
The ending. Exactly.
Yeah.
It tennis orgasm.
What I love is that this is the most explicit movie about, and I don't want to say love or sex, it is the most explicit movie about fucking, but with no fucking in it. And it's like, it's just, it's all, you know, and I'm sorry to be crass, but it was just like, it wasn't about lovemaking. It wasn't about tenderness. It is purely about the sort of act of fucking. And
he never apologizes just when it's me and him when he starts being crass. No, I just want to put that out.
I just don't want to be crass for the sake. I'm not using the word just for the sake of.
I know.
I'm using the word
but
very
pointedly. I think it's a good word to use for that, especially like match point.
Yeah.
Like how aggressive that is. Like that's not lovemaking. Like, that's fucking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the churro scene is a great example of fucking on camera because the way that, like, what I love in that scene is Paul grabbing the chair with his foot and dragging it closer to him as Art sits down and the kind of glee that they have with each other and just the way that Paul, like, Michael Faced, I think is the actor, the smirk, like there is so much done with the corner of his mouth in this movie that I was like, I just like, just fell in love with it. And like Guadagnino is not afraid of close-ups, you know, like, you know, just very intimate camera shots with these two and every sequence is played that way. And I even love the scene that is teased out so much in the trailer and probably in the artwork for this movie is the three of them on a bed. But really that scene, you know, not a lot happens in it other than kissing, but it's really about the power dynamic that's in that Tashi figures out immediately about these two characters. You know, like she initiates it, she brings them together, then she sits back and watches what she's created. And that is the relationship that is going to be tested throughout the rest of the movie. And it's like, it's fiendish, but it's brilliant. And it's like, it's a great example of why this dynamic will sustain this movie as well, because it's so interesting where they come from and what their relationship is. Like these two guys, if without her appearance, would have probably quite a sweet and tender relationship, but it is kind of like, you know, bisected immediately by her and like rips them apart in a really interesting way that they both kind of enjoy. And so this is the second episode where we've talked about Susan Sontag in a row, probably. I think we did. We talked about her in our Civil War episode as well. But I think that like it was May December, which kind of did have a sort of self-awareness about camp or a sort of an acknowledgement of the sort of aesthetics of camp that worked within that film. And I think this one was pure camp without any of the acknowledgement, but just more of the pure joy of it and the pure aesthetic, like, embrace of it without any kind of like
There's no wink.
There's no wink to the audience. There's no like, hey, this is what we're trying to do here. This is what it is. And it is brilliant. I think it's so propulsive as well. So I actually wanted to bring that back to like the Amy Pascal of it all. So during the Sony hacks where Amy Pascal was the head of Sony, she was fired from Sony because of emails that had been exchanged from her. But there was a sort of, there was a book that came out around that time. I can't recall what the title of it was, but I was reading it and they were talking about really her philosophy about what a studio should do. And she was really one of these spearheading the idea of, you make a franchise IP film in order to gain funds so you can do more interesting films. And so in that respect, she was, you know, she spearheaded
The Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back approach.
Yeah, except James Bond and Spider-Man,
that was the film where Ben Affleck and Matt Damon do that. You do the safe picture, then you do the person. Yeah. Yeah.
And Amy Pascal really lived that philosophy where she was really working on both Little Women, the Steve Jobs film, and really leveraging Spider-Man and James Bond in order to get those films made. And that's what she was really interested in. She is still a producer on Spider-Man, but I think this is a really great example of what she's kind of been talking about or trying to get made is a film like this, which is ostensibly kind of still within the realm of not, you know, it's not a franchise IP. It's not a Spider-Man or a James Bond, but it's a crowd pleaser in a way that maybe those films haven't been in a long time and reaches out to an audience that I think haven't been tapped for a little bit.
Because it's for adults.
Yeah. For adults. But it's also like taps into the sort of childish part of being an adult. You know, like, it's fun to watch. It is sexy. It's funny. It's not heavy handed at all. It's, you know, it's a little long, but it's just like, it really revels in being a grown up and having like dumb feelings.
I think visually, I love it, but I do think visually it is heavy handed. And really? I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a feature, not a bug. Like, yeah.
Them having sex under like the big poster of them.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty heavy handed.
Yeah. Like, well, even just
not
like,
heavy handed in the way that I don't think there's a moment where the collapse of Art and Tashi's relationship is a devastation to the world of these characters. I think it's like an interesting dynamic that's happening at that moment and the film moves on.
But I think how it's not how the relationship outside of tennis specifically is portrayed. Sure, I think that's pretty close to the vest or whatever, but like I'm saying the entirety of what this movie does, like even that scene where they have sex right in front of the poster, it's during like the most like trash-laden windstorm I've ever seen in my entire life. And I'm like, what? Like, that? How on the nose? But I'm like, I don't care. Neat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It works so well. And I think it requires a kind of like, it requires a kind of master filmmaker to be able to like, just kind of throw caution to the wind and know what they're doing and not really give a fuck.
This is going to feel weird, but I just thought of it sort of what we were just talking about, basically using these excesses or these like big ways things and not caring and still having it like really work because it's just so fun and cool. I don't know how this might be. This isn't a perfect analogy. It's a very broken analogy, but in my head, I was like, when's the last time like just dumb excess actually worked for me in a film, like in a film that's not like a superhero movie or something, you know what I mean?
Well, it's funny you say that because I saw a tweet where someone was like, oh, this is the first like kind of unabashedly like gay blockbuster movie like since Batman. Or like that there's like a gay reading of it, even right, if it's not like textual.
Yeah.
The Joel Schumacher's or the the Joel Schumacher's.
Yeah.
Which I feel like that is that. Where it's just like it's so big and it's like very stylized, and I feel that when that, you know, worked for a lot of people and still works.
At the same time, it's also not subversive, I guess, because we're not in like the Wizard of Oz period where we're trying to like find meaning within images that are inaccessible to us. Like we are, I feel like as a culture, much more open to a film like this. Like I don't think it doesn't feel like the sexuality between two men or the gayness of it all is under the surface or subversive or trying to get away with anything. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much there. And it's like, yeah, this is what it is. And I don't think anyone's like hung up about it. You know, like there's no concerns about it.
That's also one of the other criticisms. Like the two main criticisms are one, that it's like not actually erotic, and two, that it's like very surface level. Mm-hmm. And I think I obviously aired my quibbles with the eroticism part, but I also I like don't necessarily disagree that it's surface level, but I also don't find that a flaw.
No,
like, I think melodrama pretty squarely asks you to engage with the surface of things.
Yeah,
and that's pretty much what this is.
In the same way that a soap opera would kind of operate on that level. It works on that level.
And I don't think it's like saying anything new that other films haven't said, or like saying it, like doing anything revolutionary, but it just like works because it works. And like, that's fine with me.
Well, I think the slight revolutionary thing that it is doing is kind of what we talked about at the beginning, right? It's making the entire movie, every conversation, every tennis match, every erotic scene, be the same thing, like be in service of, and you can read it a couple different ways, as we said before, but like either playing tennis or like the weird sort of like raw emotion of love. And I'm not talking about like kindness or intimacy or anything like that, but just like the love as function or love as fuel to make people do good or bad thing. Like it everything is in service of moving the air quotes love of these three people forward to that last shot. Like there's a, I'm trying to think of something that the thing I think is sort of really nice that I hadn't seen before, things like mixing the fight scenes music like a sporting event scenes music is. And so you get the vibe of going through the entire thing. Like, I don't know. I hadn't seen a movie do things like this to get that all onto sort of like four or five different pieces of a meal, like all scattered onto like one plate for one point. I don't know. I'm not verbalizing it right.
Well, I think I understand what you mean. I think usually the thing is we see this with like show business. Like I think it's really rare to see this with sports because women like aren't usually put in sports movies, or if they are, it's not in a sport where they're like engaging with the male athletes of that sport as well.
So yeah, it's sort of Cameron Diaz in Any Given Sunday, for example.
Yeah.
You know, as a sporting figure, she's not engaged in the sport.
Yeah. Like tennis is really unique in that way. And I feel like a lot of tennis movies kind of do that, where they kind of force male and female players together.
This was the sort of criticism of King Richard, I think, at some point as well, which is that it was a tennis movie centered around, not around Venus and Serena, but around their father.
Yeah.
Which I think
is like,
a fair point.
But like you see it with show business, like something Luca said in an interview was like, he thought a lot about the red shoes when he was making this, it kind of is the red shoes, like the, just like obsession and like driving you kind of mad, and how that affects like interpersonal relationships and stuff.
At the same time, it's a great sporting movie. You know, love like White Men Can't, like I would rank this alongside White Men Can't Jump as like a great sporting movie that really explores like the dynamics of how the sport works and what it does to interpersonal relationships in order to play it. Like it is a great sporting movie. And then it structurally kind of borrows from what Aaron Sorkin did with the Steve Jobs movie as well, which is that it is like this one event being played out with like different references to past events and how they play out with that as well.
Actually, on that note, here's where I was trying to think in my head. I was like, there has to be something I didn't like about this movie. And I think it actually is slightly that structure. Not that I don't think that structure works. It does. They do micro and macro time jumps backward and forward quite a bit. And I think I was having a hard time at certain points. Not that it was ever the point, I don't think. Like, I was trying to track where things were, especially in the second act, and I had a really hard time. I thought they reference two different, like, not the New Rochelle challenge. It's like the thing that's in the movie takes place in the most part. But, like, there was another lesser one that was in the middle.
Oh, Atlanta.
Yeah, or something. And like, I kept being like, wait, is this Atlanta? And because it'd be like 12 years earlier. Then it's back, but it's like 4 days before. And you're like, wait, hold on. Okay, wait. Let me get the chart. And I know it's not important. Like, and you get the vibe of the entire thing. But if I had a quibble of my own, it would be I think they should use that structure, but the clarity behind certain moments in time was a bit off for me.
Sure. Yeah. I think that.
I think it happens because I love Paul's character being such a like skeevy, broke down on his luck, willing to like go on Tinder dates.
Oh, Patrick?
To sleep with, was it Patrick or Paul?
Patrick.
Sorry.
Patrick. Yeah.
My bad. You know, like being really, really kind of down on his luck. And so he begins, the reason why I think it's confusing is that he begins the film basically unable to get a hotel room. And then as the movie moves forward, we're like, oh, did he sleep with Zendaya right before he came to like try and find a hotel room? Is that what happened the night before? Because it happened the night before in New Rochelle. So where we thought the beginning of the film was, which was late in the evening trying to get a hotel room, there's an entire story that feels like it has a lot of back and forth in it. Like,
but was that right the same before? Night? Because there was no crazy windstorm in that scene in the beginning.
I got confused about like when was the windstorm, but I think it was that night.
The windstorm The windstorm is like the end of the tournament. It's like the day before the last game.
Yeah. So they
That's the other thing. The tournament, we don't see the tournament. We see them playing one match, other players. But then it keeps jumping back to other points in time in the tournament, which is an odd. That was a slight.
I agree with you, which is that I found myself going, where are we?
When are we?
When are we? And what has happened here? And particularly around the later parts. But I think for me, the kind of the key moments are understanding that Patrick seemingly has like a preternatural understanding of their relationship because he's been watching them on television for some reason and like knows that that Art is tired and is not going to like, you know, go the distance. And that Tashi may yearn for the ability to go even further in her career as a coach and, you know, wants to offer that her that opportunity, but also to kind of one up Art in that moment as well. So I think that's really all you got to get at it is that he kind of has read the situation and is trying to insert himself back into that relationship. And that's all, you know, like when, what happened, where I don't really know. I love there's little details in this as well. Like, and this is not a detail I would have been aware of, but apparently the Applebee's is a very famous tennis venue because in Cincinnati, when everyone's playing that tournament, the only place open to go get food after the tournament is the Applebee's. Yeah. And it's known for tennis players to go there to eat. And so it's like a well known and understood thing that's the Cincinnati Applebee's where everyone goes to eat in the middle of a tournament.
That's really funny.
And in that way, it's like I loved White Man Can't Jump because I played basketball. I don't know a lot about the tennis tour, but I found this like completely exhilarating and fun to watch and made me excited about tennis. You know, like in a sort of way where I was like, oh, maybe I should watch more tennis because this is rad.
I have a confession.
Yeah.
I always think I understand tennis. And then I watch a movie or I see a match. I was like, wait.
It's the 15-30 love and that stuff. Yeah,
I don't understand it.
It's 15-30, 45
love. Everyone who plays tennis, and my wife included, will be like, you know, groaning her eyes out at this moment right now, and us trying to figure out.
Sorry, everybody.
Yeah,
but it's not what matters.
No.
Like the basketball and White Man Can't Jump is ridiculous. Like no one plays basketball like they do, but it's fun to watch and it's exhilarating to watch. And I think the other thing that's, you know, like maybe in the last 5 years, and it's because Zack Snyder has a movie on Netflix right now, you know, there's just been conversations about like the use of slow motion. And this is a movie that like dials up slow motion to complete excess. But I love it. I loved every turn of the day. Apparently they had to find an old camera that they used to film commercials with that filmed at 2000 frames. I was surprised because there's a modern camera called the Phantom, which you would use for scenes like this. But apparently because they were shooting on film, they shot those scenes on this old film camera, which would like spool up 2000 frames per second.
Oh my God.
Josh O'Connor sweating in 2000 frames. I'm like, yes. And it's like, and it's sweating right on the camera lens. I'm like, yes, give me more of this. It's so good.
This made me really happy to see some of my friends excited about sports. Because I am a sports watcher. Right. And like very few of my friends care about them. And in fact, are the kind of people who are like, oh, the Super Bowl's happening. You know what I mean? Where you're like, okay, we're going to make that joke. You know what I mean? And I think like what I've always tried to make people understand about sports is like 30% of it is the game.
Yeah.
And 70% of it is like all of the drama around the game. It is literally a reality show about like these different athletes' lives and like what, like what's their narrative? Like if they score today, then that means that like everything that they'd been working for the whole season, like finally happened. You know what I mean? Like it's all that stuff that makes it really entertaining. And so I was really happy to like have this kind of concrete example that kind of gets at that. I mean, obviously the world wouldn't know this, that context, like if this were a real situation, but I'm like, guys, you got to watch a sports anime because that is literally what this movie is.
It's also it taps into the kind of the glamour of sports as well. These are very wealthy athletes. And I think it taps into, you know, like I think the sort of basis point for this is Mirko Federer, Roger Federer's wife, who was a professional tennis player herself, who got injured and became part of his coaching team as well. And so I think the writer had talked about watching her on the sidelines, and also the Naomi Osaka Serena Williams game where she was accused, where Serena Williams was accused of being coached on the sidelines by her coach. I don't know if you guys remember that moment where it was, so Serena and Naomi Osaka are in a kind of the finals. I, again, don't know the vernacular. And Serena's coach motions to her, and it's a coaching violation to actually like to give instruction from the sideline. And Serena gets very upset about this. She starts yelling at the coach. It becomes like a thing. It becomes an international incident in the tennis world. And I think Justin God, I'm going to butcher his name. You know, Sid. He really liked that idea that the coach was trying to communicate to the player as they were playing and not being allowed to, and that there was a story there. And then he really liked the idea that maybe the coach was trying to communicate something that had nothing to do with tennis, like it was about their personal life or something like that. And that's where the film became. But I also think, to your point, Izzy, about why we're interested in sports, it's also kind of like royal watching in a way, because it's these very glamorous, wealthy people with these like amazing stories that we get hooked into. And, you know, Zendaya, I think, is just such perfect casting for something like this, because she is, you know, this kind of larger than life international figure that like in this movie is wearing expensive watches. That is like, someone noted that the face cream that she takes out is incredibly expensive and exclusive face cream. You know, the Uniqlo sports branding on arts outfits. All of that stuff is really well considered and kind of leans into the kind of the subtext of why we're interested in this sort of material as well. And Zendaya just like looks incredible. You know, like they really tee up the film like with Art and Patrick kind of talking about like she's on another playing field. And when she comes out, you're like, yeah, she is. And like there's just something incredibly like primal about like her presence on screen, which is like you cannot look away. And like you're like, yeah, that is a prodigal tennis player in the way that we're all thinking about her. And it really, it's just like, it's such a great, the other side of this is such a great like marriage of cast and material, you know, like really, Zendaya is, I think every actress at this stage, like Timothy Chalamet is kind of going through this as well. Is like the material they pick at this point will define their careers for the next 20 years. And they have to really be careful and thoughtful about what that material is going to be. And I think this is just such a great choice on her part of, you know, picking something that's quite, probably a little bit risky, but like just really is a grand slam as far as I'm concerned. You know, like it's to use other sports vernacular, a home run as far as like tapping into a part of her in a way that I don't think Dune does. You know, like I think she's great in Dune and I like her in Dune, but I think this is like a greater showcase for her and a greater like example of like, oh, that's a movie star right there, you know?
I think they all three of them, Zendaya, Mike Feist, and Josh O'Connor do something really exquisite with their characters, because we see them across like a 13-year span, basically like right before college into adulthood, like superstardom. And they all feel, you know, Shear and I just had a birthday lately. We are all getting older. Like they feel like real people, or like the way people change across 10 years when you know them. But like, so like Mike, when he's younger, is a bit more of like a silly guy and kind of like a firecracker and sort of like always happy and smiling. And like slowly the world beats him down and like he's just tired. And like, I know I can relate to that a lot. I know people that have sort of aged into that. Then you have Josh, who is a bit more, I would even say like awkward in his youth, but then sort of finds the sort of like sexy confidence as he moves on, but also stops giving a shit and kind of becomes a dick. Like that feels like a natural progression as well. And then you have Tashi's character, who, is in control in the beginning of the movie, but still a young person coming into it, is sort of discovering what that control means, either, you know, as a tennis, as an up and coming tennis person, or as, you know, either a woman in the space or anything like that. Then at the top of her game, obviously has the injury, and then her perspective has to shift. But the sort of like, I say this not in a derogatory way, the calculating ruthlessness of what made her great before is still present. It just now has to shift to something else. Like the way they all age up in this movie, just from an pure acting perspective, like get it. And like, even when like the sauna scene between Art and Patrick is perfect, because when they're together, you see the characters revert slightly to their high school selves. And I don't know about if you guys sort of ever get this with your long-term friends, but like you'll talk to them differently than you'll talk on this podcast. Like you'll shift into different cadences and even moods or affects of your personality, because people know you from a time and it's comfortable and you just sort of shift in. And oftentimes when we have movies where characters, we're seeing them across these spans, they focus a lot more on like the visual element of it, like, ah, they look younger here, and like, ah, they look older here.
Different haircut.
Yeah, exactly. Here, I really, in the back and forth, I felt like I was watching different times in these very real feeling characters' lives. So much so to the point that this movie feels like it should be a dramatization of actual events. Like, I got the characters felt so real to me. I had a heart, like in the movie, I'm like, wait, this isn't based on like three like real people, right? Like there was some, like it was sort of presented in that way where it got me in the zone of like, even though it was over the top, even though we're watching tennis ball first person cams, like I felt like they were incredibly real feeling characters. I think a lot of it has to do with how they portrayed themselves across that 14, 13 year gap.
I think the only maybe part that I disagree with there is that I did have a little trouble with Zendaya in the older stage of her life.
She's young looking, you know,
very young looking. And I honestly, I don't think it's like a skill issue. I think it's just like an experience issue, because like a vast majority of her career, she's been asked to play teenagers.
Yeah.
And so she's like very successful playing a teenager, but it's like very, I think, different, like a different body comportment that you need to like play a mother, a mother of a 5-year-old, yeah. You know, yeah. It's like over 30. Like I had a little bit of trouble with that.
The wardrobe is kind of doing a lot of work there. The haircut's doing a lot of work there.
Exactly.
Those are the things that kind of
a bob. With. Moms have bobs, you know. So, but again, like that wasn't anything that I came out of the film being like ruined. She did a bad job. Right. Like it wasn't any like extreme problem. I kind of noticed it, but that's like it.
The mother scenes in particular was the ones I think that made the crack. But then like by the time they put the kid to bed for the last time, And she basically, by the time she says the line that I started the show with, I was like, oh no, I buy it. Like it was when it was anytime she was in Family Time, she still felt like a kid pretending to be an adult.
Yeah.
When it was just the characters, like the three mains, I think I felt it. I think it was all right with it, but yeah.
Yeah. I think the power of Josh O'Connor's haircut is quite remarkable from like, when he first appears on screen, he's got that sort of curly, bob, and then it like becomes this sort of trimmed back hair. I think also his like, just again, you know, his sort of, obvious carefree approach to his wardrobe that gets changed as he gets older and as he gets more ingrained into the life.
Are you talking about Art?
Art, Josh O'Connor's character.
No, Mike is Art. Josh is
Mike
Patrick.
Mike is Art and Josh. Yeah. So apologies.
Yeah.
I think that really, really works there. And again, you know, it's also doing this really difficult thing, which is that it's a film that's shot probably fairly quickly, that's having to span such a long period of time. So they're having to take all these kinds of shortcuts. But I bought it. I believed it. And I also I also believed the propulsiveness of it all, you know?
Yeah, I think this film made it really obvious that Mike Feiss is a dancer because, I mean, like, I think that's like the big part of aging too, right? Is like, yeah, you get a different haircut to show the different time periods and you wear different clothes, but like you could see in his body the way that he was moving as a teenager. It was so like sloppy and kind of like slouchy and like a little awkward. And by the time he's like sitting on his couch with Zendaya and they're hotel room, he's like a stiff board. What I mean, like he's doesn't want to make a single unnecessary movement. Like he's been trained to be precise.
And
you could see that, like he's so detailed, like and same with Josh O'Connor. I thought they were both phenomenal.
And the last time we saw Mike Feist was in West Side Story, right?
I believe so.
Spielberg.
He's been on some TV as well.
He's got a kind of a pretty incredible face as well. And I think a really, just that real understanding of like how his body works and how he can move it, that dancers do. It's really great work. The other thing is this, with the music, that like it is the, I think the 20th anniversary of Run Lola Run this year. And it kind of, there was a vibe to it of that sort of like, that feeling I got when I watched Run Lola Run for the first time, which was that it is, like a lot being thrown at the wall, some ideas, like by the time we were like first person tennis ball, I was like, we're just throwing stuff here. And, but at the same time, that's the vernacular of the movie at this point. And I'm kind of with it, you know, like, once the ball starts bouncing on an invisible tennis court from below angle, I'm like, yeah, that's what it is. And that's what we're doing.
It's been 20 years since Run Lola. That was my first DVD, I think.
I think there's going to be a theatrical release.
Is it 20 or 25?
It might be 25. Yeah, theatrical release of it this year. I'm seeing that. Before we go out, we did mention that we were doing this movie this week and got an email in at the last second. We have a few emails to go through, but we'll save some of those. I'll just read out this one email from Danny, which is specifically about Challengers. Danny writes, love your show. And as you know, I'm the Letterboxd list guy, so I'm also know you by now. Hey. I got super excited to see you reviewing Challengers, as a lot of the podcasts I follow are ignoring it. You truly are the only podcast about doing Challengers.
Crazy to hear.
Yeah.
I know. It feels like a talking point movie as well. Right? Like it feels like everyone should be talking about this movie. Like it's not.
Yeah.
What other mainstream film is out right now that people would be talking about? That's my
And also, sorry to interrupt, but I think there was a tweet that really sat with me because someone had tweeted like, "Oh, I can't wait to like my like I saw this movie and everybody I know is talking about it and it's all over my timeline and I can't wait to go to work on Monday and be like, I saw Challengers, and have everyone be like, what is that?
Really?
And I was like, it's so true, because I got my hair trimmed and I told them that I saw Challengers, and she was like, what is that? And I was like, oh, I forget that everybody is not just thinking about this.
Yeah.
I am surprised with that. But Matt, that is a good question. What is out right now?
I'm looking it up. Continue the email. And I'll keep looking.
Okay, Danny continues, what I found fascinating about the movie, which is by my personal opinion, the first Luca Guadagnino I've liked with no reservations, is how it utilizes the same structure of sports anime to tell its story. I don't know if either of you have seen the first Slam Dunk, but it tells the story of a single basketball game and reveals the person's life of the characters told through flashback. Combining this with Guadagnino's usual melodramatic and fantastic performances created a unique soup of a movie, but also Risner and Ross's score is incredible. I know this is a long email, but I wanted to shout out a camera movement that if I email this on time, will be mentioned maybe in this episode, but maybe too late, it'll be a huge spoiler. But I don't care because this moment is incredible. It's in the final shot match when the camera switches from POV shots of two men to a POV shot of the ball itself as the camera whips back and forth and then goes up to reveal the full court. I was in awe of this and at the ending of the movie. This is a huge spoiler where Art wins, but then he and Patrick's embrace. As Tashi has said, a true tennis match allowed for the intimate understanding of the entire interior life of her opponent. And Art and Patrick have reconciled this through the intense game, an absolutely phenomenal film that I can't wait to hear you guys discuss. Danny, I love this.
Did Art win?
That's my question. Did Art win? I don't know the rules of tennis, but I really felt like Art, and this was actually the debate me and my friend had at the end of the night, because we weren't, I don't think either of us were sure who had won or what the end of the game was. But as I understand it, they have reached match point, so whoever wins this volley will win the game, and it is ferocious now because Patrick has used an old signal to indicate to Art that he has slipped with Tashi, which I, again, draw on the floor. I was like, I knew this moment was coming, but when it hit, I was just like, his smirk so on his satisfying. Face was so good.
You figure it out like 5 minutes before, and then you're just come on.
There's a lot of slow-mo in this scene, and again, you could argue it's a little too much, but I was like, I love it.
Yeah.
And then, so there's a repeated volley back and forth, but it looks like Art jumps over the center line. And to me, it looked like he was going to miss the ball. And to me, what it looked like was that had Patrick not caught him, he probably would have tumbled and injured himself quite badly. And what I took out of it was that Patrick saw that this was going to happen and let bygones be bygones, you know, in that moment, and caught his friend and they embrace. And it was this kind of true moment of like, you are more important to me than, you know, like if you get injured, it would actually be good for me. But sportsmanship and being good to each other is kind of more important to me. That's how I read it. And I loved Tashi's cheer at the end, because I think what she had seen was a true representation of what she calls what great tennis is, which is that it's a relationship. And so that's why I loved it. I don't think that's the read everyone got, and I don't think that's the read that everyone is going for. But also, I don't think it matters. I don't know how that.
Well, that's what I was saying in the beginning. Yeah. It doesn't really matter. I didn't get the injury part like that.
I really felt like he was going to flip and get hurt. Oh. And that Patrick sees that and goes, go on.
I think I'm really close to where you're at. I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly, because I saw it a couple of days ago now, and I also like don't watch tennis, so I don't know. I just completely like misread the rules, but I thought that they were starting a new set because Josh O'Connor was about to win. He wins when he like reveals the information, because he gets an ace because Art doesn't want to return the serve, and he's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
And then he does like a dumb serve at him, which is also an ace because he refuses to do it. So then they break, starting a new set. So the point that is the final point of the match is just the first point of the rest of the game that we see.
Maybe, but it wasn't a new set.
It was they say the final, it was whatever the terminology for sudden death is. It's like it was just they tied in all of their matches, and therefore that, like, I forget the verbiage. Emails in onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. What the verbiage is? There's some thing where like that was it. I don't think it was set up to be a new set.
So yeah. But okay, I'll tell you how I interpreted it regardless of like the math of that, which is like very similar to what Shahir was saying. Like there's a like through line throughout the movie, which is Zendaya is like looking for the perfect tennis match, which like the way that she goes back and forth between these men, like for different reasons, but primarily because I think she gets different things out of them in terms of what she's looking for tennis. She gets like the lust and the passion for the game out of Patrick and the like precision and discipline of it out of Art. And like the two of them kind of like lack what the other doesn't have. So like you have this final game where like Patrick is forced to have the discipline and the precision that Art has in order to beat him. But Art, in this moment, when he is fighting for their relationship, he's forced into like the passion, like him saying, fuck you. Like, I need to fight in this moment. Like, this is, he is then expressing the kind of like lust and passion for the game that he had just said that he was abandoning. He was ready to retire. And now he's like, I'm all in, bitch. And like that kind of like leap over the thing is like the ultimate expression of that. And so her like saying, come on, you know, that's her saying, witnessing. What she's always been looking for, which is the perfect game of tennis. So it doesn't really matter who wins. The point is just like this, that's the orgasm. It is the like fruition of everything that she has been looking for in this game.
And
it, from these men.
And I took it, I agree with that as well. I agree actually with both of your points for different reasons. The only technicality thing I would say is, but again, not knowing tennis, I don't know if it's like, say, football, or if this comes up a lot where like it counts so long as you don't touch the part of the court you're not supposed to touch. So, for instance, one could read it as he hit the ball, scored, but if he had crossed the net and landed, it would have been a disqualification, but he catches him. And so like Art would technically win, but and Patrick would have technically thrown the game as other character, like as Tashi was asking him to do. Like, it felt like the culmination of like all of the threads of the plot, like, and the way that characters were maneuvering and sort of trying to puppeteer each other. Everyone got the thing they asked for at the end, even though it could be read like 9 different ways. You know what I mean? Like, everything happened. Yeah. Like, so Art, you could see, gets his groove back and maybe goes on. Patrick throws the game but saves his friend and then gets his confidence back. Tashi gets the perfect game of tennis and the thing she tried to maneuver around on the whole thing. Like, it all happens. But so, everyone's sort of still like happy at the end in a weird way.
Here's what I hope doesn't happen though, because this also, when I was leaving the theater, people were debating this, like who they thought won. Yeah. And I hope it doesn't become an Anatomy of a Fall thing where like, that's it. Where it's like a very technical question to people of like, did she do it? It's like, that's not the point of the movie at all. And so I sort of am like, so I'm like, it's funny to me that it's kind of almost immediately become that. And in a way, I'm like, that would be a kind of smart marketing move. But I also am just like, oh, God, like, I hope we aren't like still debating this in 5 months. You know what I mean?
So, I posted a video to you guys that you can watch later, but in our chat right now. But there's this famous moment from a New Zealand basketball player by the name of Stephen Adams. We was playing for Oklahoma City Thunder, and he basically, it's a famous moment where he is about to go up for a dunk. Another player, I think Mason Plumlee is the player, comes in to block him, but the sort of coordination of their shots is that he's going to tumble over him. And Stephen Adams stops and doesn't, even though he could kind of like go up and do the dunk, he was, he knew that Mason Plumlee was going to get injured. So he stops the dunk, you know, midway through the leap, and kind of turns around and picks him up. And I just kind of, I guess I brought that scene into what was happening there. But here's a bit, I think that's just a great moment. That's why I kind of think it's a great sports movie as well, because I think that kind of just plays for me, but it does. But to both of your points, it doesn't really matter. I'm curious though, through what's brilliant about a film like this and what's brilliant about writing like this is that if the film does its job well, by the end of the film, half the audience will want Art to win and half the audience will want Patrick to win, and neither will really care about who wins. But I'm really curious, for both of you having watched the film, were you team Patrick? Were you team Art? Like,
team Zendaya.
You're team Zendaya. Well, as team Zendaya, how do you think she played it? Because I think there's something to the fact that she sleeps with Patrick at the end of the movie, and she kind of does it because she thinks she's saving a family, but I'm not sure if she's doing it because she's saving a family or she's just, you know, wants to have another go with Patrick and think that, you know, there's another opportunity here. Like, where do you think she lands?
I mean, I guess I'm also really interested in the idea of obsession and how you can like fall into these holes of like doing things that you don't want to, or you wouldn't maybe choose to do it on paper, but you do it because like you're so corrupted by how much you love something.
Yeah.
So I like seeing expressions of that, and I like following her kind of villainous arc through like these men's lives. To do that, I love a traditional kind of femme fatale. Mm-hmm. So like, to me, where she lands, it is really vague. I think she makes a lot of bad, destructive choices, but I like watching her be so unabashedly self-serving about it. And so I do think, regardless of who wins that game, she wins because she got what she wanted. In terms of like seeing the best of her sport come to life in front of her eyes. And also because like whoever wins, like is still going to want her as a coach. She already got the pitch from Patrick and Art's not firing her. He's married to her. So,
I have a kid.
You know, so like, I think wherever she lands, like she will have built that path for herself, which I don't want to make her sound like a girl boss because she's really not. But like, but I think that's fascinating to watch. So I am team her because I think she's the most interesting character of the three.
I'm team none of them. And I'm so comfy with that because they're all super interesting, but they're all flawed and the way that they do their either immoral or bad things, could also be read as a kindness. Like every one of them, even down to Art, like you're never given enough information to know who is 100% if anyone is in the right. Art having lunch with her at the college, and he sort of tries to plant seeds that like maybe Patrick is sleeping around on tour or whatever. We don't see any of that. We don't do any of that. But like the way Patrick acts, you can kind of see like, well, maybe that could be the case. The thing with when she sleeps with Patrick at the end of the film, did she do it because she wanted to sleep with Patrick again? Did she do it to try to save Art's career? Both can be true. And then Patrick choosing, as Zendaya or Tashi brings it up a couple times, he comes from affluence. He's pretending to bum it around. He's being a class tourist in a certain way, because he doesn't want to take responsibility for anything, and so he'll just bumble and be a fuckboy for a while doing his shit. Like, anyway, my point is he doing that because that's what he's comfortable with? Is he doing that because there's just different. Every one of their flaws could be seen as them in a twisted version of what they're doing, trying to do a right thing, but they're still doing the wrong. And that's just the most interesting thing to me.
Yeah. I think we've all met a lot of people who are kind of like some of these people in some ways.
Yes.
Like these aren't characters that are like plucked out of like a fantasy novel. No. They're just like, you know, these have these unrelatable qualities.
Yeah.
I feel like more of an Art personally than a Patrick or a Zendaya.
I oddly felt more like a Patrick And I kind of wanted Patrick. I think what I liked about it was that Patrick, why I kind of felt an affinity towards Patrick towards the end is that he has really been maneuvering the scenario towards the end as an underdog, even though like there is this argument that he comes from affluence and, you know, but like he didn't get into Stanford or he wasn't playing at Stanford. And he has been slumming it in like the, you know, like challenger leagues while Art has been like making tons of money in the actual A circuit. And he has figured out a way to get under Art's skin so that he could win this match and get on the tour. And then at the final moment, the reason why I kind of like I'm on his side here is that he knows that. And again, the way that I read the scene is that he feels that Art's going to get hurt. And ultimately, you know, like he obviously both sexually loves this guy, you know, like emotionally loves this guy. And, you know, like has known him since he was 12 years old, taught him how to jerk off and is like, you know, he catches him and embraces him and like gives the game away. Like, you know, I kind of like that about him, you know, like this, he is the worst person in the movie, as far as I'm concerned, until the final moment. And I kind of love that, you know, like that moment that he has. So I'm kind of team Patrick, I guess, in some way.
I'm team Zendaya. I'm team Tashi. If I had to pick, because here's the thing, she's the only one who's incredibly honest about what she wants throughout the entire movie. She doesn't fucking sugarcoat it. She lies about other things related to that.
She lies by omission a lot.
Yeah, but
she's got the greatest Han Solo moment in the movie. She's like, "I love you," and he's like, "I know."
But like that's my point. Like, From frame one, or maybe not frame one, but like from their first interactions, you understand what this character values. And if you can read people, which I mean, they're infatuated and it was a love thing. So again, you do silly things when you're in those situations. So it's easy as an outside observer. But like, I just think she kind of told them both exactly who she was and what she valued. Mm. And they imprinted their own things onto what that relationship could mean. Granted, she wasn't kind about it, but she was honest with who she was.
There was a part of me that going that you could do, like to her character, was like, you could do better. You know, you could do better than both these guys. Yeah. But also, you know, just coming back to Luca Guadagnino for a moment, you know, a guy who's made body horror films. By the way, I caught his last, like, Izzy, you were talking about like movies not getting a lot of play. You know, he made a Cannibal Road Trip movie with Timothée Chalamet a couple of years ago that didn't get a lot of play. And I was like, it's kind of amazing that, you know, he did that. And I watched it last night. It plays. I kind of liked it. I liked it a lot more than Suspiria. But the Luca Guadagnino of it all, of like understanding body horror in a sort of profound way, the moment when Tashi busts her knee is a moment, again,
the
you kind of know
effect
what's,
moment.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen and you know it's coming because there's a part of you that
you've seen the trailer.
Knows. Well, no.
I know you hadn't.
I hadn't seen the trailer, but also like you go, okay, she's not playing anymore. She's a coach now. So something must have happened to her. And so you know that every match that she goes out on is kind of met with a little bit of peril.
You see her scar.
And then she, like when it happens, it is like a, you know, it's like a gasp moment when it does happen. It is like visceral and kind of like it does play into the body horror. And, you know, she is kind of like walking around with this like with this cast on. And it is a great tragedy that this person who was set up to be one of the greatest players that ever lived and who is ferocious and who like they understand is one of the greatest players that could possibly live has all of that taken away from her. So when that happens, I actually don't like, I don't see her as being villainous. I kind of like go, well, you know, like there's a great tragedy to her, which is that she loves the game more than either of these two and was better at it than either of these two. And through fate kind of had that taken away from her. And so now this is the game that she plays. And I ain't hating, you know what I mean? You know, like take your big expensive, you know, your expensive night cream and your fancy watches and your expensive, you know, like, yeah.
I loved the scene where she takes the knee brace off And then they do that like soap opera, like zoom in on her face. There's no camera move in the movie like it, and they just do it there. And I was like, this again is an intimate moment that you'd made an over the top camera choice, and it works. Like,
I was noting that scene as well, because they obviously have the money for a dolly, but they chose to do a zoom lens in that sequence. Yep. It was a very purposely,
it's very deliberate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was cool. It worked.
Yeah.
And again, I love that in the end of the film, there is a zoom dolly that's a complete mess of a zoom dolly. Like, it's on Patrick's face during the final sequences. And you can tell that they either just rushed it, or they didn't know where they were going, or it was on purpose to be that way. But it was a mess of a shot, and it's just in the movie. And it's like, yeah, let's do this. You know, I gotta love that. I love that kind of approach to it. I wish I was that confident a filmmaker to like be able to like, you know, throw caution to the wind and say, fuck it, that's what we're doing. So I love watching that.
For sure.
Any other last thoughts on Challengers?
I want to see it again.
I think we all liked it. Yeah, right? Yeah.
I want to see it 10 times. Like, I think there is a question mark around how much money this movie is going to make. And it's been interesting to watch this up against something like Roadhouse, which is another Amazon release, but one that they decided to opt straight for streaming. I watched Roadhouse, the Jake Gyllenhaal film remake. And it's not great. But honestly, you go, this might have played better in a theater. And I sort of make that same equation here, which is that I don't think this plays as well at home unless it's had a really good theatrical run where people can talk about it and then bring it home. Like, I think if this had gone straight to streaming, I think, you know, like Bones and All, the Timothy Chalamet film probably would have got lost in the shuffle. So I like that it's a big theatrical film. I like that I saw it in Dolby Atmos. I like that it's playing in IMAX of all places. It really does sort of speak to, and it, as long as the money comes in for it, it speaks to kind of like the importance of the theatrical release model for a film like this, because it's, you know, it's a three person menage a trois around tennis, you know, like you're selling that to the IMAX crowd. And I think they will be pleasantly surprised.
I know. Yeah. I think it really just is about like getting people over that hurdle.
Yeah.
Because I think like Zendaya should be a pole.
She should be,
herself.
Right?
Yeah. I think tennis is a weird sport for Americans. I think, I mean, obviously we have like Serena Williams and like a bunch of really famous people, but it does feel like a sport that kind of like has a very European air about it.
Yeah.
Also, I think it is interesting. Like, one of the things that is kind of like a, for lack of a better term, white elephant in the film is the fact that like Zendaya's black.
Yeah.
And it's never really addressed except for when she says like, you know, these white boys or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, like, I do think it's one of those melodramas that's like not concerned with that exactly. But I do feel like that is one of those things where it almost feels like with tennis, especially like we know what black tennis players go through.
Yep.
Yeah.
That would come up in her life.
Yeah.
I think, wasn't there a Vanity Fair profile of Zendaya? Like there was an article floating around this week called, it was discussing Zendaya's movie stardom. And I think they were addressed that. And I didn't read it. I kind of feel like it's unfair to do sometimes, you know, to like address her race as a factor in whether her stardom ascends, but it's like something that is, yeah, like you say, in the ether of the subject matter. Mm-hmm. But like you say, I also don't think the film is that concerned with it. And I don't think
it needs it, but it is something I was thinking about at the end. Cause like, that is just such a, like a huge thing that is talked about with tennis.
I mean, like look no further than King Richard, you know, a film that literally directly hits that topic hit on.
Yeah.
So I agree with that as well.
Well, this has been the only podcast about the film Challengers. Sadly, that might be accurate if according to our Twitter polls. Izzy, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me. I love chatting with you too.
It's so fun. Where can folks find all of the things you do and their wonderfulness across the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at BK Rewind, Instagram at BK_Rewind, and Twitter Be Kind Rewind. I said Twitter. I meant YouTube. YouTube is Be Kind Rewind. There you go.
Izzy, I have been out of the loop for a little bit. What are some of the video essays that we can check out? I know there's been a Barbara Streisand video recently that I haven't watched yet.
It was a podcast too, things. Right?
Yeah, I talked about Barbara Streisand's memoir on Nebula. So if you have Nebula, you can check that out. I published in March a video about Judy Garland's concert at Carnegie Hall that has subsequently become a very famous live album. So it's just like the context about why that was made and sort of why it lives on and why it's so good. So if you haven't watched that one, check it out. I had fun with it. It's kind of long, but I think it's fun.
Nice. Always love checking out your work. And again, very happy to have you on the show. Come back more often, please.
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm always here. Please.
Shahir, when you are not, just so many things to do with this movie. Propositioning your ex to teach you tennis in a windstorm. Where can folks find you?
Whoa. A lot of memories just came back to me all of a sudden. You can find me at my website, www.shahirdowd.com, reminiscing, or my company site, Suvanova. That's S-U-V-A-N-O-V-A. Matt, when you are hitting balls over a racket repeatedly, where can people find you?
You can find me getting all of the verbal and racket abuse yellow cards. What is it? Penalties? Warnings?
Fouls?
Yeah. I don't know. Over at my website, I'm just going to say extra history, youtube.com/extra history and youtube.com/extra credits. Or you can find me on Instagram at Skeletor, the number 4 PREZ, or Emperor MSK on Twitter. Yeah. Next week.
There'll be a movie. Tran On Huang's film, The Taste of Things, on my, which I rented for the plane trip that I haven't watched yet.
Cool.
The First Omen, I hear, is very good. I would like to see that.
I looked up what's out right now.
Oh, yeah. What's up?
Oh, yeah.
So not a lot. So Civil War, still going. Yeah. Abigail, the vampire, I think the vampire little girl ballerina movie.
Yep.
Which I saw the trailer for, and I'll see that on a plane. It'll be great. Boy Kills World, which is a Bill Skarsgård movie,
never heard of that.
Nope. But then it's all re-releases. Oh, and the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Fall Guy.
Is that out yet?
Yeah, it's coming out.
I want to see The Fall Guy.
I for some reason, because of the press tour for that film, I feel like it's gonna be fun, but also very much like, hey, let's all go to the lobby kind of movie. You know, like, I don't know. There's something about it.
I have
like,
literally no interest in it.
Yeah.
I just like both of them. And I'm like, I'll go watch this movie about stunt. It's fine.
If we're doing Josh O'Connor, Like Chimera got a lot of great reviews and everyone's talking about movie. I've heard it's excellent. And I hear he's great in it.
So
guys, the only podcast. Have you done Godzilla versus Kong?
No.
Godzilla X Kong?
No.
No. We did Godzilla minus one and
that's
we decided
cinema.
Did you see Godzilla X Kong?
I love Godzilla. I see every Godzilla movie.
Oh, I think we knew this.
Yeah. I went in Hawaii.
Godzilla minus one though?
I did. Yeah, I did. I love Godzilla minus one.
Yeah.
It was great.
Izzy, we have a short coming out on Extra History about Godzilla, I think, next week.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm going to watch.
I do want to bring this up. Then there's a lot of re-releases.
Right.
Which is becoming more and more prevalent, and I'm not mad at it. Spider-Man 3, for some reason, re-released.
No, they were doing a run of all the Spider-Man movies over the last month, so they did 1, 2, 3, amazing. They're going to do them all.
Alien 45th Anniversary re-release.
Now, here's a fun fact. Alien was released on the day of my birth, which is also telling you how old I just turned.
Wow. And then this is the one I'm the
Shrek
most...
Shrek 2?
Yeah.
Hey now, you're an all-star.
You have to watch that in the quintessential format it was meant for, and that is in beautiful 112i on the Game Boy Advanced. 15 frames a second. It's great. But the movie that's being re-released right now that I think I need to see in a theater... is The Mummy.
Oh, yeah.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yeah.
Don't think I've seen The Mummy.
How dare you? That's crazy. Have you seen the meme, what is your sexuality? It's just the cast of The Mummy.
I've been on the Mummy ride at Universal.
Not the same.
In Florida.
Not
and it was
nearly
great.
As sexy.
Yeah. Can I make a pitch for one too?
Yeah.
That
sure.
I really liked at New York Film Festival. Evil Does Not Exist, which is the new Ryusuke Hamaguchi movie.
Ooh. Yes, I've heard about this. Yeah.
And it's playing at Lincoln Center right now. Or it will be this weekend.
All right. So we've got a big grab bag there. Write us in onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. Tell us what you're watching. Tell us what you want us to watch. Just to wrap us up before we go away, my son watched Dune 2, had some thoughts about it, had some spicy takes. I decided the best way to lay that out was to record him talking about it. So I had to cut down a 10-minute conversation. We talked about a lot of things. We cut out the conversation about Lord of the Rings. We cut out the conversation about sandworms that he didn't like. We cut out the conversation about Fayed Rafa that he didn't like. And just distilled down what his final thoughts were on Dune 2. And
did you censor your son?
I did. I censored my son. Although I let him watch a PG-13 movie.
I need to know what his Lord of the Rings takes were.
Yeah.
He hasn't seen Lord of the Rings. The assessment here is that after having watched Dune Part 1 and Part 2, the next thing he wants to move on to is to watch Lord of the Rings. And actually, right before this podcast episode, the reason I was running late is we started watching all of the Lord of the Rings trailers so he could see what the movies were. And we watched all three trailers. He also, this is a little fun fact about me, is I was an extra in the third film.
Well, I was going to say, you're from New Zealand, so I feel like
everyone
this is a cultural moment to share it with your son.
But I got to be honest with you, I'm not the biggest Lord of the Rings fan. Like, if he wanted to watch Heavenly Creatures, I'd be like, fuck yeah, let's do this.
Right. Maybe not yet.
Maybe not yet. But I'm not the biggest Lord of the Rings fan, but he does tell everyone that I was in the movie, even though I was an extra. In one scene in the third movie. So we were running late because we're watching that. So he's got a lot of takes. He's been on the podcast before. I can't remember what, Toy Story 2, Frozen 2, something like that. It's been a while.
Dread. Kids stuff.
Kids stuff, yeah.
We will play that to send us off for the evening. Izzy, thank you once again.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
And we'll say goodbye with Laszlo.
Bye,
yeah, you can't see it, audio listeners, but it's a puppy. Okay, children's review of Dune, take it away!
Okay, so tell me what you thought about Dune 2.
Not that good.
Really?
Yeah, just the plot was some kind of, like, dumb.
Really?
And just, like, it ended, like, when they could have done, like, 3 more hours at least.
Oh, so you wanted more of it.
It's just, like, I wanted to actually properly end.
You wanted it to end in. What do you think is going to happen to Paul after the events of the movie?
I have no idea because it literally doesn't finish the movie.
Oh, what do you think is going to happen to Chani?
Ride a sandworm.
So what did you like about it?
The fight scenes.
Yeah. What do you think of Fayed Rafa?
He was actually pretty strong. He just killed his servants, though.
Yeah, he killed people for no reason.
He killed people just so he could test out his blade.
Yeah. What did you think of his battle with him and Paul?
Nothing really happened. It was just a normal fight.
No.
Like, it was just like all the other fight scenes.
Okay, so Dune 2 or Bluey? The 30-minute episode of Bluey?
Bluey, honestly.
Yeah, and did you like the episode of Bluey?
It was way better than Dune, because it actually ended.
What's the next movie you want to watch?
Lord of the Rings.
You want to watch Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, Mom said the battle was way scarier.
The battles in Lord of the Rings are pretty epic. Okay, well, would you want to see the next movie, which I think is going to be called Dune Messiah?
Yeah, I guess.
Do want to see it. You do like the Dune world, right?
That's the world I like. It just, like, sometimes they need to introduce a new characters.
Oh, well, what about, yeah, they introduced Fayed Rafa.
No, I mean, like, a new main character. Like, a character that survives for, like, a long time. Fayed Rafa died on the one movie started in.
Okay, what's your final rating on Dune 2?
Out of how many stars?
Four stars. Out of four.
Five, actually.
Okay, out of five stars.
Honestly, two.
Two? Whoa! Okay, wait, and just for comparison, Dune 1 out of five stars?
Four.
Four. And then just for comparison, Bluey 28-minute episode out of five stars?
Three
stars. Fair, you got a two, a three, and a four.
Yeah.
What's a five-star movie for you?
Pacific Rim Uprising is a five-star.
It is?
Yeah, because, okay. Like, the battle scenes are really cool.
Okay.
What's a one-star movie that we've seen?
Honestly, if it's not a one-star, Star Wars is like a three-star for me.
Star Wars is a three-star?
Number one. No, wait, two-star. Two-star.
A New Hope is two stars for you.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I hate it.
All right, that's fine.
Oh, I know a one-star movie, Elemental.
Elemental's a one-star movie?
Yeah. Only because, but that gets into opinion because I hate Elemental.
Really?
Yeah, it's a one-star movie. No, wait, that's a zero-star movie.
Wow.
I hate love stories.
Really?
Yes. That it knocked it off. All 5 stars.
You might change your mind as you get older.
Okay, yeah. But right now, Elemental is the worst movie I've ever seen.